Welcome to the first edition of the Wiggle Room. And yes. As you can tell, we're sort of making this up as we go, and we'll explain a little bit about the Wiggle Room is here in a moment. But first, I just thought we'd introduce ourselves. My name is Dana Longley, and I am the Assistant Director for Library Services at SUNY Empire State College. I do a little bit of everything, and don't let the Assistant Director throw you. I am just a regular librarian with a glorified title. I do a little bit of everything. And sitting to my virtual left is Carlene.
I'm Carlene Huxley, and I'm the instruction coordinator at Jefferson Community College. And right now, I guess I kind of do a little bit of everything too, but I'm not like Dana. I'm not like a jack of all trades person. I mainly do the instruction. I also take care of reference a little bit, and I do a lot of the sort of public. If you want to call it public relations, I take care of the Facebook fan page and that kind of stuff too. So that's me. And then I guess to my virtual right is Mark.
Hi, Mark McBride from Buffalo State College. I'm the library liaison coordinator and blended librarian, which means they won't call me an associate director, but they just let me do everything. Yeah, they just kind of mix me up and put me wherever I fit in.
Hey, I think that's a good spot to be in, Mark. I like that.
Yeah, I do too. It keeps you on your toes, and I just love my job.
As long as they don't put you in too many uncomfortable places, you're good to go, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I love getting my hands in a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I do too. I do.
Yeah, and I think that's the best thing about our profession. I it's interesting they call us. You know, the handle blended librarian, I don't know if that's buzzword bingo or whatever, but I think for the longest time, librarians have always been blended in some way, shape, or form.
Very true. And just a little background for our right now non-existent listeners. WIGGLE, it stands for the Working Group on Information Literacy or Instructional Literacy. Information Literacy, I believe. And we are... What brings us all together is sort of an interest in library instruction, information literacy, and as well as emerging technologies. I think, does that sort of sum up sort of our mutual interests?
And, yeah, I think that sounds good.
Yeah, I like it.
And WIGGLE is actually a part of the SUNY Librarians Association. Although I should mention that, you know, this podcast is not officially sponsored by SUNY or SUNY Law. And anything that we say in this podcast is going to be off the cuff, and it's not representative of our institutions or SUNY or SUNY Law, just so we can get that legal mumbo-jumbo out of the way right here from the beginning, right? And we can talk freely.
I like it.
Okay.
Good deal.
So I thought we might start out by just maybe talking about, some of the things that are of interest to us right now, that there's maybe a project that we're working on, that we have an interest in. And then, you know, a little later, we talked about e-books and e-readers and how that fits into academic libraries and specifically instruction as well. So does somebody want to start about a project they're working on?
I guess I'll go. I don't really have any major projects going on right now, but... being the instruction coordinator, this is sort of a new role for me. Last year, I was just the reference coordinator, so, you know, I'm learning a lot of new things, and one of the things that I'm trying to do right now is they used to the previous instruction coordinator made a really great information literacy tutorial. There we go. There's the phrase. And he hadn't been able to update it for the longest time. And he updated it last year, but then the problem was that we weren't able to get it on the website because IT actually does all of our website management stuff, and there were some problems there with getting it up onto the website. So over the summer, I read my director pointed me towards an article in – I think it was Reference Quarterly. I don't remember which one. But there was an article about using LibGuides as a way to put up your information literacy tutorial. So that was kind of my project of the summer. I basically took what John, the previous instruction coordinator, did and created and just planted it into the LibGuides, which is going to be nice because it's something, you know, LibGuides is something we control. We can change at will. So we can update it, you know, easily yearly as opposed to the last one where it was, you know, it was a big ordeal to actually get something updated and changed on the website. So
yeah, sounds like a great way to bypass the IT lock on your content.
Yeah, that's nice. You know, and it's, you know, for all the IT is great. It's just that, you know, they have a lot that they have to manage on a website, so they can't always, you know, for whatever reason, they can't always get to us or oblige, you know, our needs for whatever reason. So that this way we can't. We can just sort of bypass that and then use our own tools to be able to provide the students with that tool, with that information literacy tutorial.
So is that tutorial actually hosted on the SpringShare servers?
No, it's our own server. So, like, for instance, I can find the website address now. I don't know
But you can display it in the LibGuide. So, in other words, I just wasn't sure whether the disconnect with IT was, like, sort of getting it stored on your servers or just getting your library website updated.
Yeah, just getting the library website updated, which that alone is actually changing now, too, because they just hired a webmaster, a really great webmaster, and he's just now getting into a huge overhaul change on our website, too. But, you know, there's a lot to do there. So the idea is for us to be able to have it on the website a little more viewable in the future, I think, but this is at least something temporary that we can do for now. So.
Go ahead, Mark.
So the library hired a webmaster?
No, it's the IT department. The IT department hired a webmaster.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's so basically what he's been doing just this past summer, they have like a four-phase project, I guess, and the first phase was to gather, you know, information from the campus. They basically met with us separately, like they met with the library as a department and said, what do you need on the website? What is it you're looking for? And what are the problems that you've been having? What are the students having problems finding on your website? You know, getting that information so he can use that to actually create a better website. Because right now I've had people tell us that our website sort of reads like a phone book. It's just a lot of text and really difficult to find things. And he's really been working hard, and he's been helping us out a lot. We finally got him to put icons, like our Twitter icon and our Facebook icon and all that stuff on our website, which in the past we didn't have that before. So, you know, just those small things, those visual things that we think might help students to, you know, guide them through our website and find things. I think it's going to help a lot. So.
I can imagine that.
What's wrong with reading a phone book, though?
What's wrong with reading a phone book?
People just click on the first one they see. That's what happens. That's why you see all those businesses with AAA at the beginning of their name.
That's right.
If we had all web pages like that, you imagine all our database vendors would start naming all their products like that.
That's right.
I can imagine, Carlene, that like being in that situation where like it's so hard to get changes to your website. Does it like sort of tamper down some of your enthusiasm for making innovation?
Yeah. Well, it did, especially, you know, like for instance, we have a blog and we have a Facebook fan page and we have a Twitter, and we have Camtasia, you know, so we can make tutorials and stuff. But we had no way to put that anywhere where people could actually see that we had it, if you know what I mean, you know? So it did. It sort of, you know, I got to the point where I didn't really want to do any of this great stuff that I knew how to do because, well, what was the point? Because I can't connect it to the students through the website anyway. You know, I could do all I could. I could, like, I would make brochures and stuff in the library. And, you know, at one point we had a blog inside Blackboard because Blackboard has a blogging software, so they wanted me to use that. So I used that for a while and thinking that, well, if it's in Blackboard, then maybe they'll see it and they'll access it that way, but they didn't. And, you know, so it does. It really does sort of curb your enthusiasm for it because, you know, you want to put it on the website so people know that it's out there. And then when you don't have control over that, then it's kind of hard to actually want to do it. So I don't know. Yeah.
Do you have some assessment tools built into this tutorial? I mean, I know, for example, LibGuides at least allows you superficially to see, like, who's clicking on what links or what resources within a page.
You know, I haven't really put anything – I mean, besides what LibGuide provides us with, I haven't really put anything on there. What I planned to do was to use, you know, LibGuides has sort of that questionnaire thing at the end of it saying, you know, is this guide helpful, you know, that type of thing. I'd also plan to put, if I could, a lot of them have, what was it that I did, if I can get to it now? After each module, I used some sort of free website, and I don't remember the name of it now, but it was one where you could create quizzes for the students. Something like that. You can embed a quiz. I think I actually used Google Survey originally. So I embedded that in there so at least the students could take a small questionnaire at the end of the module to see how they did.
Okay.
So that way I can get that. Of course, once they've taken the survey or the questionnaire, that gets popped into my Google Docs, you know, as an Excel spreadsheet. And I can actually see how they answered it and then also, you know, take a tally on how many people have actually taken it. So that's really the only assessment tool that I have on there yet for now.
Well, that sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm hoping it'll work and help. So.
You can only see, and hopefully, you know.
I know. That
sort of thing will help point out any problems or anything like that. Like, how are you marketing this? Like, how are students going to find it?
Well, what I'm planning to do is I'm going to contact the – there's a few instructors that the previous instruction coordinator told me about who really like to use the information literacy tutorial. You know, a lot of the stuff I find really does – it is just word of mouth, too. You know, connecting with the instructors themselves and telling the instructors to tell their students about it, having them require it to do it in class, telling them about it in our own instruction, you know, when we have students in here for library instruction and stuff. You know, so that's really as far as I've gotten with the marketing part right now. I'm still actually trying to complete the entire tutorial, so I guess I haven't gotten too far with the marketing part.
But it sounds like
so if you have any ideas, yeah, that would help. That would be great.
I think faculty are definitely the key.
Yeah, I've always thought.
Plugging away at them.
So.
Mark, what are you working on?
Well, it's interesting you talk about LibGuides because here at Buff State we're working with something called Subjects Plus, which is an open source subject guide that was created, I believe, in Ithaca or at Ithaca College. And don't quote me on that. I think I'm right, which is mainstay in my life. I always think I'm right. But with the with the subject, because we do have a webmaster here. He worked on inside the library, and he worked on getting our Subjects Plus up and running. And you know, I really am a big fan of LibGuides, and I was really skeptical with Subjects Plus. Our subject guides are looking a lot better. We're ready to launch a newer version, which is going to allow our librarians here to take more ownership and control over the content. What was most interesting to me was the fact that our webmaster really got his hands dirty with PHP and working with the SQL databases, which seems to be probably much more beneficial to us in the long run than the actual subjects guide.
What kind of things is he doing with that?
Well, I mean, you know how open source software works. I mean, it's somewhat plug and play when you take it out of the box, but you really have to work with customizing it.
Yeah. So, I mean, as far as like users, like what was the advantage of? Because I can see there being advantages, at least theoretically, in being able to go in there and play with the guts of things and make it do exactly what you want. Which is, you know, I'm finding I love LibGuides, but I can't do some things that I want to do.
Right. Yeah. There are limitations.
Right. I think with Subjects Plus, you know, because you know, librarians, we have this like this entrepreneurial spirit, and I think that's what drives us to this profession. We always come up with wonderful ideas, and what we've been able to do is say, geez, you know, I really wish the subject guy could do this, and then our webmaster Dennis Reed would say, well, let me take a look at it. You know, he would more often than not grind his teeth as he walked away. But then I would get like a text message on a Saturday night and saying things like, hey, I figured it out. Check it out. And pretty much what we're trying to do is load up video content, we like flash animations. We want to do screencasts and things of that nature. we want to embed Twitter feeds in RSS, which is, you know, almost similar, but, it, you know, Twitter's a slightly different variation on the RSS. But essentially what we want to be able to do is we want to customize it to the individual librarian. So the individual librarian comes out in the subject guide more than just the subject guide itself. So it, it kind of gives a little personal touch, which I think is a real benefit to any type of librarian, I guess marketing would be the term I'd use, is that you kind of put yourself out here.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Does that mean that you're giving each of the librarians some leeway in how things are presented, how they're organized, how their display of things?
Yeah, primarily that's what we're going to do. I mean, there's going to be some content that's going to be somewhat static, meaning that, you know, we have a process in place and a procedure, and this is the way we're going to do things, such as our course guides and whatnot. But we'll be able to make the content individual to the librarian, because there's some librarians who, you know, who still like to give out handouts in their class. And I'm just not that type of person. I prefer to almost work without a net. I really want to, when I do my instruction, I prefer to make it more lively and more animated and show that there are pluses and negatives to working without really having a plan, which most people, you know, most students, when they start out with their research, they really don't have a plan. They just try to shoot from the hip. Where some of our librarians, you know, they want to know what is going to happen every step of the way. They want to know minute by minute by minute what's going to happen in those 48 minutes when they do their little instruction.
Yeah, not to get too far off topic, but I think that's a good topic in and of itself. You talk about instruction, and there's a sort of fine line between, you know, or maybe even a dichotomy between, you know, having so much planning that the instruction just becomes rote and it becomes boring, and, you know, you've been in those classes where you just have an instructor, not even just a librarian, that's just lecturing, or, you know, just reading off the handouts or the slides or whatever, versus, you know, to me, I've always found the most stimulating instructional opportunities are those instructors that can work off the cuff and that feed off of the things that they're hearing from their students. And it's it's an equalized thing, although I think it takes a certain kind of instructor to be comfortable to do that, and a certain amount of experience as well.
Yeah, you definitely have to have the experience. To me, it's a little bit more authentic when you work without the net. And I know there's some librarians that can do a great balance of both, where they can say, here's a little canned presentation I'm going to give you now. Here's an example of, you know, whatever Johnny wants to search. You know, what's your topic on, you know, using, you know, interactive media for a teaching platform. Okay, this is how I would search for that research.
Yep, and, you know, having just, well, a year ago now, graduated from immersion, the idea, the concept of the authentic teacher was a big one in the ACRL immersion program. And, I, you know, it really resonated with me, and so it's something I'm always constantly trying to define within myself. I'm still a work in progress myself, but you're trying to find your authentic instructor voice.
Yeah, I remember reading a blog post about that from library. What is it? Lead pipe. You know, lead
library,
pipe library.
In the library with a lead pipe.
There you go. Yeah, they had a really good post on that. Was it 2 years ago? It's been a long time, but I printed it out and it still stays with me. That it was. I think it was even called authentic librarianship. And yeah, that's. I think that really is something that students connect with more. You know, I think they come back to you after that too when they have that authentic interaction with you. You know, they're more apt to come back and ask you questions later, and then it ends up making for more of a better relationship throughout their college career if you've established that with them.
Yeah, and I think I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that article, because that article is pretty much what led me to start doing this on my own, because I was more of that formulaic type of instruction, and I really wasn't bringing myself into the instruction. I was just kind of going up there and going through the ropes and not feeling really comfortable with it. And And I'm not a – I mean, I can talk on one lip for hours and hours and hours. I'm not uncomfortable talking in front of a group of people. But for some reason, whenever I got in front of a classroom to do instruction, I would freeze up. And it was just so not my nature. And when I read that article, I thought, you know what? I think maybe this is the direction I should head in.
Right.
I wonder if that's like something that's – because, I mean, you know, like in my – MLS degree, that kind of thing wasn't really taught, at least in the classes that I took. Granted, I graduated a while ago.
Well, I graduated 2006, and the instruction, you know, information literacy class I had was, it was very formulaic in the sense that we basically talked about the ACRL standards, and then we all had to, you know, get in groups. We had all these group projects all the time where we had to develop an instruction that were based on those standards, and then we were evaluated for it and all this stuff. So, you know, back in 2006 anyway, I don't know what they're doing now, but, yeah, I don't remember learning anything about really being able to connect with students. It was just, you know, this is what you need to teach them. This is what they need to know by the time they leave class. So.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
I think, you know, there's one of these big things out in the sort of blogosphere, in the library blogosphere, about reevaluating the MLIS degree programs from all different aspects, instruction just being one of them. And just,
right.
Because I think there was a big recent blow-up about, you know, sort of ALA over-promoting the availability of jobs and all these, like, new librarian graduates griping rightly that there's just no jobs out there and that, you know, ALA is just lying about, you know, all these librarians retiring and all this sort of thing.
Well, I think they were going to retire, but then, you know, they either love their job too much or they, you know, they can't afford it.
I was going to say, how can a librarian not love their job?
Exactly.
I can't imagine retiring. I'd be bored.
Oh, I can think
I love
of a few
doing this job.
Like you, but, yeah.
Okay, well, I guess I'll just talk about one thing that I'm doing, and then maybe we can jump right into the e-books and all that, that whole world of stuff, unless anybody else has anything else they want to discuss.
Nope, I'm good.
Go for it.
All right. Well, one of the things that we're doing, we're just trying out, we're going to be launching actually next week, is something called, we're calling it Online Research Assistance. And basically what we're doing is we're attempting to fill the gap in between and maybe I should give a little background about where I work, because where I work is very atypical of librarians. Empire State College, we don't have any physical books. We don't have a building. All our students, at least the library, are distance learners, and they're mostly adult distance learners. So we don't get the ability to, for example, go into classrooms or bring classrooms into a building to do instruction. So for instruction, what we do is we use a software called Illuminate, which is an online classroom environment, synchronous, to deliver some voluntary instruction classes. And in addition to that, on the other end of the spectrum, we have a whole variety of online reference services, chat, email, all that sort of things. And this new service is sort of attempting to bridge the gap between our very limited instructional opportunities and the reference opportunities that all our students have. And what the idea is that students can go to a website that we're setting up, and they can see the schedule of sort of online office hours that librarians have. And they can set up, they can schedule an appointment with us online, and then through using either Illuminate or just the phone, if they're more comfortable with that, at the scheduled time, we'll go through them and they'll have their assignment in front of them, or they'll say what they want to learn. And we'll sit down with them for half an hour and do that, ideally in a virtual environment. We're in Illuminate, we can do a shared browser experience. We'll have voice and chat, and we can have a whiteboard. And so we can sort of offer more opportunities for our students to, you know, get up to speed on information literacy skills that they need to succeed.
Wow, that sounds like, yeah, So they, I mean, have you had anybody using it yet? I mean, is this
we're launching
yet,
it next week. We have all the pieces in place. It's just a matter, I mean, one of the biggest pieces that we're still sort of working out is, you know, how to market it, how to promote it. And right now it's sort of limited in scope because one of the things I didn't mention is that, including myself, there's only 3 full-time librarians here serving 20,000 students. So in addition to all the other things that we do, we have to sort of add this on to what we do. And so we can only offer, right now we're going to start offering like 6 half-an-hour slots per week that students can sign up for. So that's right there. It's going to have a limited impact. But we want to sort of just start out slow, beef it up, and then hopefully get some more staff on board and be able to offer this so that at more times, more days of the week, so that students, and our students are working adults, so they have jobs, they have families, they have kids. And so there's a wide variety of needs as far as times and days of the week and times in the semester when they need this sort of instruction. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that, you know, we can get the word out about that and the demand will go up and then I can put in for more librarians. But we'll see. Right now it's just the first step, and I hope that it'll be successful. And, you know, right now we'll probably still have to work out some kinks as far as, like, you know, signing up and getting information from the students and making sure students, you know, call us at the proper time and are able to get into the Illuminate platform and all those sorts of technical and sort of workflow issues that will come up in a new program like that.
What do you really feel is your biggest challenge with your job? I mean, I'm sure there are many.
Our biggest challenge is real simple. It's communication. It's promotion. It's just letting students know that we exist and that they can ask questions of us, and letting them know the resources that they have at their fingertips. Because when we have students at a distance, you know, we can't force them all to come into a library and give them a walking tour of the library to at least let them know that there is a library. You know, the vast majority of our students don't even, you know, meet face-to-face with their instructors. They'll talk with them on the phone a lot, and they'll do other sorts of things. So they're getting bombarded with all this other information, just getting the word out there that, you know, we have this very large online library available to you guys is really our biggest issue. Everything else, I mean, you know, once you do that, there's other issues beyond that, you know, especially in my mind in the sort of information skills, information literacy area. And how do we get our students up to speed with that? Because we're dealing with adult learners, some of whom, you know, haven't gone to school in 10, 20 years. You know, how do you get them the skills to be able to succeed in an online academic environment?
And go ahead. Well, I was just going to say or ask, you know, do the faculty, I mean, can they help to provide, because I know you talked to me one time about branding. I mean, you guys don't even have a name for your library. I mean, it's basically just the Empire State Library, right?
Or the Empire State Library. Yes, you're right. You know, how do you give something that doesn't have a real building a name? Things like, I had an idea, well, let's just offer an alumnus if you donate some money to the library, you know, we can slap their name on our online library.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that would work. If you get some person with a weird name, I'd feel weird about it. But, it's going to be an issue. I try and, you know, every day to harness faculty members to get the word out about us. But, I mean, our faculty are also at a distance for the most part. So even just getting the word out about them. I mean, I'm still shocked. I've been working here for 7 years now. And there's still an occasional faculty member, you know, on the other side of the state that barely knows we have an online library, and let alone, you know, is telling their students to come to us. So it's an uphill battle. Just, you know, in the online environment, communication is always going to be the biggest issue, and, you know, getting the message heard in the, you know, plethora of channels that students are getting information from is a steep uphill battle. But, you know, we're getting there. You know, I just sent out an email to people internally here, and just to say that, you know, our reference volume, like I ran some statistics a little while ago, our reference volume is up 50% from last year, and is up 250% in 5 years. So, and our staff has not gone up at all in that time. So the word is getting out. It's just that probably not to the extent that I want it to be. As, okay. So shall we move on to our sort of main topic for the evening?
Sure.
So we're going to talk about e-books. Well, sir, this is what I have written down, so correct me if I'm wrong in this, and we can, you know, we can certainly go off in any tangents we want to. My philosophy in this whole podcast thing is let's just go where the conversation takes us, right?
Yeah. Who knows who will end, right?
Down, so
yeah, right.
E-books and other media and e-readers and iPads and tablets and the issues that arise from that in academia and in libraries and whether, you know, there's probably been, you know, news items of interest out there that you guys have heard of. You know, what are your thoughts? Maybe first of all, put this question out to you guys. What are your thoughts on sort of the big thing in sort of e-books and e-readers right now, which is the iPad? And number one, have you guys been able to play with that? And number two, like, are your libraries considering investing in something like that or something, you know, a similar sort of tablet or e-reader technology for your students in the library?
Well, at Buffalo State, we bought two iPads for the library, and the premise of it was to play with them and find out what they're capable of and how we envision them possibly being used, not just in the library, but, you know, in the classroom, outside the classroom, just on the college campus. And you know, I played around with the iPad, and, you know, I don't know if Caroline or you have, Dana, but I'll tell you, the best thing about them are the apps. And I started reading a book one night on it, and I was thumbing through it, and it was pretty cool. And I got about three pages into it, and then I checked my email, and then I went back and I started reading again, and then I wanted to check some baseball scores. You know, I was easily distracted. With a traditional book, I'm not, and I've also played around with a Kindle, and with a Kindle, I just straight read. I didn't really deviate from the task of just reading. I just stayed the course, which I think the iPad is a great little gizmo, and I only think that we're seeing the beginning of what this whole mobile platform is really capable of, and it's a wonderful beginning because I think it's really going to transform what we do as educators and as librarians. But for me personally, I feel more of an attachment to something like a Kindle. But again, I have a problem with a Kindle because I don't like the fact that I'm stuck to just one platform, you know, where I have to purchase, you know, what goes on my Kindle won't necessarily move over to, let's say, my friend's Nook or possibly the Nook that I buy.
Their own, proprietary format, from what I understand.
Yeah, exactly. So if I'm a classroom teacher and, you know, I have my Kindle and I want my class to all read the Odyssey, if some student comes in with the Nook, what do I tell them? Sorry, you know, you can't take this course.
And I think your point about, like, sort of being distracted, I would, to go back to that for a second, I think that's a pretty important one because, you know, I think it was just an article that came out maybe in the New York Times or something like that about how they did some survey, and adults at least are, and my guess is that, you know, younger adults as well, check their email and are distracted way too easy with the, you know, ubiquitous of, you know, checking their emails. And so having something like an iPad, which is sort of a, you know, as opposed to like a Kindle or just a physical book or textbook or whatever, that has multiple uses and multiple functionalities on it. Would that make it a lot harder to concentrate on reading your textbook, which, you know, I can remember, even if it is long ago, I can remember the pain of trying to sit through and read a textbook, you know, being what they are.
I don't know. I got an iPad for my birthday, so I've only had it for maybe a month or so. I'm distracted very easily too. but and I can definitely see what Mark is saying, because I had problems like when I was watching, like Netflix, say on my regular laptop, there are times when I would minimize, you know, the movie so I could actually just check my email real quick. And then I can't do that with the iPad, because if I get out of Netflix and I actually have to stop the movie and then check email and then get back into Netflix again. So, you know, when I started doing the multitasking thing on iPad, you know, I realized that this is what I do all the time, that this is how I sort of live. And I just bought a book. I bought The Help. And so I haven't really had much experience, like, reading it for a long length of time. But there's also that part of me that understands that there is a distraction there. But then I remember that when I was reading textbooks in college, I would start to doodle, you know, in the margins of the textbook. You know, there were other distractions that were getting me then too, you know. So this distraction element, I think, is, yes, it's a problem. But in every – I don't necessarily think that it's the iPad's problem, that it's the iPad's fault. I think that it's probably something a side effect of this society and the technology that's in this society and just us in general haven't quite evolved enough yet to really understand how to control our focus in the way it needs to focus in this day and age.
I think you nailed it, Carlene. I mean, it's definitely a cultural problem. I remember I was talking to Harry Pence and Oneata, and he brought it up is, you know, all this technology that we're engaged with, you know, the eye candy moment of it is kind of gone away. And now we have to really focus on what this means to us culturally.
Right. And we've got to learn this. You know, I think I'm starting to see even more articles out there in the blogosphere, especially talking about how not to get distracted when you're trying to do work on the computer. You've got alerts everywhere and all this stuff. You've got your Twitter going on. And, you know, it is. It's a cultural thing, and it's another thing that we're just going to have to learn as a culture as well. It's a challenge. It's a real challenge, and I haven't mastered it yet. But I guess the point that I wanted to make is that I still think that the iPad is probably the better e-reader because of its application capabilities and the fact that I can, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, if I wanted to get to download a book from OverDrive, I think there was one of the articles that you had sent us, Dana, where the librarian had to actually get the book from OverDrive at the library from the computer first before she got it to her Nook. And, you know, I'm thinking that there are more capabilities with the iPad when you can do that all on the iPad itself and not have to use two different technology tools. Does that make any sense there?
Yeah, no, that might just be a matter of the sort of newness of the sort of e-reader technology. Because
right.
I imagine that, you know, those extra steps will be cut out in future iterations of whatever ends up coming out of these so-called e-reader wars.
Because that was one of her complaints, was that she couldn't just go to her Nook and then download an e-book just right onto the Nook. She had to go to the computer first to do it and then, you know, basically get it from the computer to her Nook after that. It was an extra step that was involved.
Well, I think, you know, like the Kindle can download directly. It might just be a particular design choice of the Nook. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I'm still so new to this whole ebook thing. Like, of course, I have the iPad. I just do it from Apple Bookstore or something. I don't remember what it's called. It's iBookstore, isn't it? I think. Yeah, you know, I look at these things. This is a distraction problem coming in here. Is I do things, but I don't actually read what it is I'm doing. iBookstore. There we go.
What about the issue of, like, you know, number one, the sort of closed nature of the iPad. And number two, the cost. My God, the cost of the iPad. I mean, you're talking $500 for the basic model. Granted, that's going to come down over time, the same as all the other sort of e-readers have. But does that create barriers to offering it in the classroom where you have to be conscious of cost to students?
Yeah, I think it does definitely. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, the cost of it, I look at the class I'm teaching right now, I teach a 3-credit course, and kind of also piggybacking off what Carlene was talking about, learning to locate the balance. And believe me, I'll tie this all together, I promise. on Thursday, the class is a Tuesday, Thursday, and on the Thursday class, we meet in an informal learning space where the students have to officially unplug, meaning they're not allowed to use just a regular desktop computer, but they have to just actually sit back, listen. Maybe we'll watch some videos or do some demonstration, but mostly it's going to be a discussion about the research and things of that nature. And the goal of that was to, you know, to locate that balance between plugging in and not plugging in. Well, this Thursday we attempted it. It was the first shot at doing this, and we're using Tumblr in the class to act as like a live journal of the class and to have students use to publish little mini comments on their research and what they're thinking about in contemporary society. But we had a problem, of course, with the technology because not everybody got their invite. So on Thursday, we were forced to throw out the entire class and work on the little problem with the technology. And we brought computers and laptops in just so we could have the students get their Tumblr accounts up and going. And some of the students took their phones out and they used their phones to get their accounts up and going. And you know, I sat there and I thought to myself, you know, of course they did. I mean, I'm of the ilk where I think not all students can afford to use or to buy these smartphones. But I also know that if a student really wants an iPhone, they'll go eat peanut butter for a month in order to have the new iPhone. I got friends who were in their 50s that would do that. And I think that's because we're such a heavily technology-centered society anymore, and maybe that's part of our, you know, I don't know if it's part of our commercialism culture or whatever it is. You know, I don't even want to get into that, but the obvious thing is that mobile computing is going to come to education because guess what? It's already here.
I agree 100%.
And I think that, you know, when we look at the ebook readers, and again, they're at their, you know, they've just been born. You know, they're just starting to understand the market themselves. I think that, you know, over time, when we start thinking about what this means in the classroom, we look at the iPad right now or we look at the Kindle, 5 years from now, it's not going to look anything like that. And that, to me, is exciting and at the same time rather scary because what do you jump in on? What do you invest your time and your money in?
Yeah, right. You wonder about, like, because I'm reading all these stories that pop up every day about, you know, this college is giving out iPads to all their students in these classes and is doing away with textbooks and just using iPads. And I'm like, well, that seems sort of weird that the school is making that decision for the students about what learning platform
they need to, yeah.
Yeah. Because it sort of locks them into using that. So basically that school, it's like sort of, yeah, when the schools choose either Pepsi or Coke, you know, they'll only sell that on their campus. And that's very controversial in itself. And I'm wondering if the same thing, if we'll see some sort of cycle of that. In other words, the next thing, you know, Kindle's going to start, you know, marketing to all these colleges and even to high schools and even elementary schools, getting that, you know, we want you to use our product, because really, for example, something like the Kindle, they don't make their money from the hardware. They make their money from the books. So once textbooks get into the realm of being more everyday, which I think, you know, they're getting there, but they still have a ways to go, that we may see that kind of thing where we're going to see, you know, at least initially, that, you know, campuses will be choosing one device. Because I'm not sure how it could be manage any other way where you could just say, because of just the proprietary nature of some of these machines, that, you know, oh, well, you just need to have some form of either laptop or iPad or something like that. With all the DRM that's on all the e-books, it's hard to manage that with so many different machines that you'd have to dictate it. You know, well, in this class, everyone's going to have an iPad or whatever.
Right, right. Well, and there's, you know, there's also the the popularity of renting textbooks. I mean, I don't know about you. I mean, I really didn't want my textbooks when I was done with them when I was in college. You know, I mean, if I was done with the class, I was done. Yeah, I mean, nobody does. So, you know, I honestly, there's that part of me that we sit here and we talk about all the different e-readers that are out there. But, you know, when it comes to textbooks, the students are probably still going to want to rent them instead of actually even purchasing, you know, some sort of e-reading device or even being given one as opposed to purchasing the e-book of the textbook. They probably would rather just rent it, and then that way they can get rid of it easily by the end of the year, you know? I mean, I think that's still probably more attractive to them than, you know, the snazzy gizmo and everything. Especially at our college, being that we're a community college, I mean, there are students here who can barely afford a regular paperback in their creative writing class, you know? I mean, it could be different in four-year colleges. You know, students might have more access to more money, but around here, I mean, if we told them, you know, yeah, you're going to need an iPad to be able to access your ebook or access your textbook, it wouldn't fly.
Oh, no, it wouldn't fly here either. I mean, and I don't know. I don't think it would fly at Empire as well. Because
it definitely wouldn't.
You know, and especially in today's economy because, you know, as much as people want to buy the gizmo, nobody wants to be told what they have to buy.
But that's my question about this is how is an industry, like a textbook publishing industry on an ebook platform supposed to develop if institutions that are going to use those things can't, I mean, how do you put all those pieces together without that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know much. I mean, I'm still trying to understand all of the problems with the DRM but to me, that's just a huge brick wall for us. You know, it doesn't seem like anything that even for the publishing industry, unless they start developing books that are cross-platform, so students can choose, you know, e-reader they want to use to actually access the ebook, that it's ever going to work for anybody. Is that kind of what you were talking about?
Yeah, no, I think you, as Mark said earlier, hit the nail right on the head there. It's really, I mean, it's from what I gather, from what I read, what little I know of this, I'm certainly no expert, that it's really sort of in the publisher's court right now, because they're the ones that, you know, sort of are and then when I say the publisher, I also mean like the, you know, Apple, Amazon, and the other big names in e-books, and coming up with a standard for that, and not locking down their devices like Amazon and Kindle have, so that all of them can read a PDF. And we need to actually, you know, if textbooks are going to take off, we need to go way beyond PDFs, but. You know, is it going to really become ubiquitous? Are the big, huge textbooks that cost $300 ever really going to go away? If, you know, for this class, you have to have this device to read it, and this other class, you need something else.
Right.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, if they're going to market to the educational community, they're going to have to change something because I don't think it's ever, they're never going to make money off of it.
Yeah.
As a librarian to a student, I'm probably going to tell them to buy the hardback, you know? I mean,
the other side of it is in the sort of ebook collections as a library, because, I mean, you know, we have a fairly large ebook collection aggregate, you know, we have, like, eBrary, we have...
Right, like SpringShare and NetLibrary.
And those, you know, we have, I just took a tally of our ebook catalog. We have over 90,000 titles in it, which is pretty good for us. And actually, you know, more and more in talking to sort of publishers of ebook collections, for example, Springer makes it so you can download those. I think we have like 30,000 ebooks through them. You can download those, and I think they're just PDFs. So in most cases, those books, they aren't textbooks. But,
yeah, I actually just used one today. I used a science one, and you hit the download button, and it comes up on my iPad just like a straight PDF. It's very readable, and I mean it's just a book. I just checked it out. Yeah.
I think you know that we're going to see more and more publishers and vendors probably moving towards that.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at what Pearson's doing right now, I mean, I mean, they've bought up Malirio. Is that the ebook reader? The digital reader they just bought up, and you know they're buying. They just bought up I forget the name of the company. I can't remember these companies' names, but they. I remember they just bought up somebody that creates content management systems. I think Pearson is seeing that this is the trend that they're gonna have to take, mm-hmm. and you know you couple that with a software that's coming out like Blio. That Ray Kurzweil's behind, you know, and their big thing is they don't want to make it platform specific. You could load it up on your $500 Dell netbook and it'll run the software and you could, you know, read any book that's out there electronically and it'll play on the software. At least that's their goal.
I think it runs into the DRM thing because the publishers, content publishers, want to lock down that content because you know, and obviously in a digital environment, it can be easily duplicated and distributed. At least that's their fear.
Right, right. And you know, with Blio, I mean, they're partnering with Baker and Taylor and you know, which is like the number one publisher that's out there. I think that, you know, at least the people who are behind it, I think they understand that the gadget or the platform cannot be nearly as important as the content, and where content is definitely the king.
Right.
Yep, and there's a long way to go in that.
Yes.
And especially in just making, you know, because I think, you know, right now ebooks are still just in the point of not taking advantage of the things that moving it to an ebook platform can possibly do. It's now just, all right, well, so it's a electronic version of a printed book. That, you know, really you're just taking away some of the flexibility of the book but not adding in a lot of the potential advantages of the electronic environment that but you know that'll probably be coming, just hasn't gotten there yet. And I think
right.
Another issue with ebooks is that specifically with libraries is that you know in buying ebook collections like eBrary, what we're doing, and the same thing, you know, goes to the database collections that we purchase, you know, we're moving away from the model of actually purchasing printed books so we have those and those are in our collections. So now we're moving more towards renting these books from these vendors. And once our subscription to eBrary ends, you know, that bam, those ebooks are gone.
Mm-hmm. That was a problem that we had with whether or not we were going to choose them. We discussed that for the longest time, that, you know, is that really worth the money that we're giving them? And then if we end up not being able to afford them at some point and, you know, we have to, stop the subscription, then all of a sudden all those books are gone again. And then we have to fill those gaps in our collection. So it's,
I wonder if anybody's ever done sort of like a cost-benefit analysis between the cost of maintaining a physical collection, how much it costs per year to staff and organize and house a physical collection versus renting a physical collection.
Yeah, I don't know, but I sure would like to see those stats. That would be helpful.
Yeah, that's interesting. It would be something to take a look at.
Because I imagine that, but I mean, you know, I guess the real issue that a lot of people have, and I can see this, is that, you know, there's a real danger when you just move to everything electronic and renting content. The libraries, you know, because libraries traditionally have always been sort of, in some ways, to the detriment of the profession, seen as the sort of repositories of culture and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, we house all this knowledge and make access to it. So if we just, you know, where does our role come in once we're just, you know, we're just purchasing access to these things and letting our users loose on to whatever platform the vendor makes available. I don't know does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. And let me ask you this question. And is anybody on their campus, do they know anybody that has moved to more of an e-textbook, maybe moved it into their learning management system, whether you're using Blackboard or Angel or Moodle or...
No, not on our campus.
I know some of our faculty members are inquiring about it, but I think there's just a lot of obstacles to making that happen.
We did have... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say we did have one a parent of a new student called us a couple of weeks ago, asking questions about whether he should purchase a textbook for his daughter because she had an iPad. And I'm not sure. I guess the bookstore sent him to us. So that's the only inquiry that we've had. It's actually from like a parent of a student. We haven't had anything from faculty or from students on campus.
We definitely, like our international students, international studies faculty, because it's so difficult to get textbooks to our overseas programs, they definitely contact us and, want to inquire whether, the textbooks are available as e-books or whether there's optional e-books that we can get access to
right.
So their students don't have to, wait a month into the start of the term to get their textbook. That's one example of that.
What do you usually tell them? Like, where do you refer? Do you refer them to CourseSmart or do you, to get a textbook?
You don't make a specific, we refer them to the bookstore and they usually have some things that they can work through to get done. But, we have our e-book collection and so we'll usually make an effort to say, maybe we can look at some of the things because we have purchased a couple hundred titles, for example, from eBrary where we have perpetual access to those titles. They're not going to go away no matter what.
Of actual textbooks?
No, not of textbooks, but of books that might be used.
In their classes.
Yeah,
okay.
In their classes. Not as a textbook, no. Although there is some minor that, depends on the content, but there's no strictly textbooks available through eBrary that I know of. I imagine, it may come someday, but, yeah, I don't know. Well, I think, the recording here has hit an hour. Should we wrap things up or you want to keep going?
Sure. Yeah. I'm starting to float a little bit.
I'm starting to fade a little bit. Yeah. I had about 4 hours of sleep last night, and our college is officially closing at 3 today.
Oh, okay. Well, you get to go home early then.
Yeah.
I keep getting text messages from people saying, where should we go after work?
They're ready, huh?
Yeah, I guess they're ready.
Well, then I guess we'll wrap this up and say, so I think this has been a pretty good conversation, you guys. What do you think?
Yeah, I've
enjoyed
it. We'll
try and do this again, and hopefully we'll get the word out there and see if people like what we're doing. And we'll keep it going. So maybe, for next month or whenever we want to do this again, we can brainstorm about some ideas. I mean, one of the things that I had was the concept of transliteracy that's, I think, growing more and more in the library world. And, maybe discuss a little bit about that. And I think it's still not a very well-known term, but it's potentially, I think, a possible sort of replacement or an umbrella term over information literacy. I think that has some interesting connotations that might be discussed.
Let's do it.
All right.
Yeah.
Does anybody else have anything to say? Do you guys, if you want to put it in there, have plugs for any blogs or Twitter accounts or anything like that you guys want our listeners to go to?
I'm good. I have a blog, but I hardly ever blog on it anymore, so I don't I don't have time, so I don't need to plug that.
Mark, your film company?
No, we'll keep that underground as long as we possibly can.
Okay, well, I didn't mean to blow the cover on that. I'm sorry. Well, I'll just say, if people are interested in seeing what I do out on the web, you can find me on Twitter at disobedientlib, and I have a blog which I only do occasionally, but it's called the Disobedient Librarian. You can find that out there, and I'm all over the web.
Yeah, and you live up to the disobedient part.
I try to.
Yeah.
I try to.
Well, and also I'm going to put a little plug in for lib300.tumblr.com. That's a little blog we're going to be using for the for my Library 300 class, which is the three-credit course I teach.
And by the way, congratulations, Mark, about the excellent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education you did.
Oh, yeah, that's good for the ego.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Dana. I appreciate it.
I was very impressed, and you talked about that class, and, it'll be cool. I hope you can, maybe next time we'll get a blog or something going around this podcast, and we can post a link to that that.
Yeah, I was just
going really
to ask you about that. Being able to have a physical space for the podcast somewhere online so we
definitely
can post the links that we talk about. So that'll be good.
You can work out the details on email and go from there. All right.
Thank you all.
And have a great, hopefully, a 3-day weekend for everyone.
Yes.
Should we have like a catchphrase, like a sign-off catchphrase or something?
Yeah, what is it?
I have no idea. How about that? I have no idea.
It's time to get jiggly in the wiggle room. How about that? No, that's a bad one. That's probably not very good.
That's the best one we've got so far, Dana. So we'll
okay,
stick with
we'll try opening up with that next time. All right. Well, we can sign off. Thanks
all
for
right
listening.
WFMU.